Today on the Rachel Maddow Show, we are doing something that strikes fear into the hearts of the staff here. On occasions for special shows, I sometimes get a wild hair to go for it on a topic that is hard to do in our usual newsy, headline-driven shows. We are, by necessity, driven by the day's headlines, right? We're the newsy show on Air America. We're the way to get your day started with all the information, all the headlines. You can know if you come and listen to us for the whole show, you're definitely going to have a better-than-the-average bare understanding of everything that's in the day's papers and everything that people are going to be talking about, particularly in national politics. That said, sometimes I get obsessed with stuff that I feel is running like an undercurrent through the day's news, through the current headlines. But the undercurrent itself, that thing that is underpinning everything else that's happening, doesn't itself make headlines, right? It's like a wizard behind the curtain kind of thing. Last Thanksgiving, we did a special show on immigration. And I said at the time, last November, that immigration was due to be the big political Republican wedge issue bugaboo of early 2006. Ahem, right? Our other special show last fall was about Katrina, about recovery on the Gulf Coast. And today's show, our third ever special show, I'm sure you can already guess what the topic is. I feel alone in this. But the thing that I have been obsessing about alone, the thing that I think is secretly driving some of the most important headlines in the news these days, but nobody is talking about it, is, well, it's Iran-Contra. I know it sounds weird. It's an 80s scandal. Actually, as of this winter, as of this late fall, we will be coming up on the 20-year anniversary of Iran-Contra. But on July 4th, today, on the country's birthday, I think that flashing back to a couple of important things about Iran-Contra, more than anything else I know in the day-to-day headlines these days, getting a little Iran-Contra refresher and kind of doing a where are they now in terms of what's happened to some of the characters and some of the ideas that were exposed during Iran-Contra, looking back on what happened then 20 years ago with the lens of what has happened since and what's going on in the government right now, more than anything else I know of right now, can help explain the big picture, the 15-second explanation, the big, scary idea, the one thing that is most wrong with the Bush administration, what is wrong with this current form of republicanism that is ascendant in government today. It's like it's uncanny. It's like a little Rosetta Stone decoding everything that's been happening lately on the big picture issues in the Bush administration. All these things that seem unconnected, you can tie them all to Iran-Contra, and through that lens, through using Iran-Contra as a filter, really get a very clear calibrated check, a very clear calibrated look at what is really going on with the government and the real magnitude of what they're trying to change about who we are as a country. A little story about it, a little example. The NSA spying scandal. The government, you know, listening in on our phone calls without getting a warrant, right? One of the things that I've always thought was most important about this story, and I've been covering it from even before the New York Times busted out their expose last December. One of the things that always seemed to be absolutely key to me to understanding why the NSA story was important was that the Bush administration had the opportunity to do this thing legally, to do what they did in the NSA spying program without violating the law. Without violating the law that says you need a court order. They could have done it legally. They had the chance to do it legally. A Republican senator, Mike DeWine of Ohio, before the whole NSA spying scandal thing came to light, in 2002, Mike DeWine proposed legislation 4 years ago that would have amended the FISA Act to allow the NSA to listen in on calls without a warrant. He proposed legislation that would have made legal what we now know they were already doing illegally. At that time, 4 years ago, the Bush administration told Congress that they were not in favor of changing that law. They advised against it. They said no. The Bush administration knew at that time that they were doing this illegal program. They had the chance to do it legally without anybody having ever found out about it, and they asked instead for Congress not to act to make what they were doing legal. They preferred to do it secretly. They preferred to do it illegally, in violation of laws, in violation of the FISA law that was passed by Congress. Why? Why would they prefer to act illegally overacting legally? Why would they prefer to act on their own accord against the wishes of Congress than actually have Congress make what they were doing legal? Why? Back in December, right after the New York Times ran the NSA spying story that broke open this huge scandal, on December 20th, this past December, Dick Cheney was flying on Air Force Two around the Middle East. If you look at the White House transcript of this discussion on December 20th, it says that he was on his way to Oman when Dick Cheney decided to have a rare back and forth with the reporters on his plane. Reporters wanted to ask him about the spying scandal. He was in the rare mood to talk. And he told the reporters, he volunteered, without being led into this in any way, that if they wanted to understand his view of government, why he thought the NSA thing was okay, if they wanted to understand his orientation to government, Cheney said they should go read his take on Iran-Contra. Random, right? That was 20 years ago. It's such a random thing for him to bring up, but he literally told reporters, go find this obscure minority report that I wrote. He said, nobody's ever read it, but it's my, basically he said, it's my philosophy of government. And we spelled it all out right there in 1987 when I was a Republican congressman. I was the top Republican on the committee investigating Iran-Contra. And nobody's ever read that thing. But if you ever want to know what I'm trying to accomplish in government, if you want to know why I think this NSA spying thing is okay, and it's totally central to what I believe about government, then go read this report. Back in 1987, the Democrats were in control of Congress. And Congress formed a joint committee, both the House and the Senate, both Republicans and Democrats. Wow, remember those days, right? They formed this committee to investigate the Iran-Contra scandal. Cheney, vice chair of the committee. He was a congressman, the ranking Republican on the committee. And, you know, even if you don't personally remember Oliver North testifying on TV that summer 20 years ago, you probably know just the basics about the scandal, right? The Contras were rebels in Nicaragua. They were anti-communist rebels. And the Reagan administration was having a little love affair with the Contras. The Reagan administration had a fetish, generally, for arming and training anti-communist guerrilla groups. It was kind of a rent-a-death-squad Cold War foreign policy. We propped up dictators and death squads and thugs and monsters secretly to stop the tide of communism from lapping at our shores, to not give the Soviets a beachhead in South America. That's what they did, right? Kind of like what we're doing in Somalia and Pakistan and places today, if you replace the word communism with terrorism. In the 1980s, Reagan's plan to support the Contras was exposed. The Wall Street Journal reported that the CIA had been secretly mining, literally putting mines in the harbor in Nicaragua, which was not allowed, right? And Congress said, you know, Reagan, we know that you are desperate to fund these Contras. We know you love nothing more than to arm the death squad guys, but you cannot just unilaterally do this without telling anyone else in government. You can't lie about whether or not you're doing this. You have to pretend you yourself, Ronald Reagan, are not a South American dictator. And we, your American Congress, say that you can't fund the Contras. You can't do it. You can't mine Nicaragua's harbors. You can't send them tanks and fighter jets. You can't airdrop them M-16s. You can't. You can't have the CIA do it secretly. You can't have Oliver North do it privately in his pants. You can't. You can't. The U.S. government is more than just the president. Congress says no, and we make the laws. So, of course, the Reagan administration went and did it anyway. but they knew that Congress was not enthusiastic about this prospect. So they had to find some way of keeping it all off the books, even more off the books than just having the CIA do it. Where can they get the money to fund the Contras? From another little illegal deal the Reagan administration had going on secretly on the side, selling millions of dollars worth of Hawk missiles and anti-tank missiles to Iran, about $30 million worth, more than half of the money that Iran secretly paid for that secret weaponry we weren't supposed to be selling them, more than half of the money they spent on it got sent to the Contras. That's what the Iran-Contra investigations were investigating. An administration that broke the law secretly in order to do stuff that they were explicitly banned by law from doing. That's what Congress was investigating. Dick Cheney was the senior Republican on that committee. What that committee found, what Dick Cheney dissented and said, which he now says is the foundation of his whole view of government, will blow your mind. And you'll know why I'm obsessed with it. We'll be right back with today's special edition on the Iran-Contra affair and how it tells us what is going on in our government now in a way that nothing in today's headlines can do so clearly. This is a special edition of The Rachel Maddow Show. Happy to be here.
Stay tuned into Rachel Maddow's mind all day long. Visit Rachel's blog at maddowonline.com. iPod with Rachel Maddow and Air America Mornings. Get Air America Premium.
The fact of the matter is that there's nothing I can say that would make the situation right. I was stubborn in my pursuit of a policy that went astray. The other major issue of the hearings, of course, was the diversion of funds to the Nicaraguan Contras. Colonel North, Admiral Poindexter, believed they were doing what I would have wanted done, keeping the democratic resistance alive in Nicaragua. I believed then, and I believe now, in preventing the Soviets from establishing a beachhead in Central America. Since I have been so closely associated with the cause of the Contras, the big question during the hearings was whether I knew of the diversion.
Yes, indeed, that was a big question, Mr. President. Welcome back to a very special edition, a very special 4th of July edition of The Rachel Maddow Show here on Air America Mornings. We're standing back today. We're standing back 20 years and squinting at today's headlines and finding that some really important stuff in today's news is remarkably easier to understand from that distance. You know, you can hear in that little clip there in Ronald Reagan's defense there, you can hear a little bit of the George W. Bush playbook, can't you? You know, you kind of vaguely apologize, but you never really apologize for anything. You cast even your failings, your stubbornness, as some sort of perverse personal virtue. And then you immediately go from that to scaring people. Sure, I was stubborn, my fellow Americans, but there are communists on beachheads down there. It's just the parallels. But there are more parallels. There's more to the connections between this scandal 20 years ago and today's headlines than just the rhetorical connections, right? The Iran-Contra investigations 20 years ago were looking into an administration that had broken the law secretly in order to do stuff that they were explicitly banned by law from doing, breaking the Iranian arms embargo to sell weapons to Iran, breaking the Boland Amendment, a law that had been passed by Congress that said you can't support the Contras. They wanted to do both of those things, and they went ahead and did it, though they knew it was clearly against the law. And this joint House-Senate committee found, basically, their findings can be summarized as follows, quote, "The common ingredients of the Iran and Contra policies were secrecy, deception, and disdain for the law. A small group of senior officials believed that they alone knew what was right. Administration officials repeatedly evidenced disrespect for Congress's efforts to perform its constitutional oversight role in foreign policy. The idea of a monarchy was rejected here 200 years ago, and since then, the law, not any official or any ideology, has been paramount." All direct quotes from the findings of the investigation into Iran-Contra. That's what the committee found when they looked into Iran-Contra. Dick Cheney, the ranking Republican, the ranking minority member on that committee, disagreed. Filed a dissenting minority report, which said that the problem in Iran-Contra was not that the president broke laws that Congress had written. In Dick Cheney's mind, 20 years ago, the problem, the real crime in Iran-Contra, was that Congress had passed laws in the first place that deigned to say what the president could do. The guy who is currently sitting in the east wing of the White House, we know he's unpleasant. We know he told Pat Leahy to go F himself. We know he shot a lawyer in the face. But the thing that I think we have forgotten about Dick Cheney, that he has personally been trying to remind us of himself by repeatedly bringing up Iran-Contra in recent months to explain himself, the thing that we are just not grasping about Dick Cheney, the ideological and legal engine of this administration, is that he is beyond radical in terms of what he thinks this government should be. He was radical then, he's radical now, but boy, you can see it clearly then when nobody was really paying attention to him. There is a guy driving the most important policies of the U.S. government now, the policy engine of the White House, the most powerful vice president in history, who has openly advocated for 30 years that the Congress is a suggestion box, that the president is a king who answers to no one, that there is no law that can constrain the men who sit in the executive offices at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And he's one of them now. We need to recalibrate our sense of how crazy the Bush-Cheney plans are for changing the American government. And the best way to do that is to look at what these guys said were their plans at a time when no one was paying attention to them, because they were not mincing words at that time. They said exactly what they wanted to do, and in the intervening decades, they have set about doing it. Happy birthday, America. It is July 4th. Let's scare the pants off you. Coming up next, stay tuned for my interview with John Nichols, D.C. correspondent from The Nation magazine. John says all this could have been avoided if the Democrats had just had the good sense to impeach Ronald Reagan 20 years ago. This is The Rachel Maddow Show here on Air America Mornings.
Your brain can hold more than you think. Air America Mornings with Rachel Maddow.
Welcome back. Happy July 4th. This is The Rachel Maddow Show, a special edition on my current obsession with the Iran-Contra crisis of 20 years ago. The idea of a power-mad presidency certainly did not start with the Iran-Contra affair in the 1980s. But that affair sure did bring it into nice, sharp relief for those of us who are concerned about this factor and this drift and this drive in the George W. Bush presidency. We're joined on the phone now by John Nichols. John is the D.C. correspondent for The Nation magazine. He's the off-comer. He's the author of a forthcoming book called The Genius of Impeachment, which is due out this fall. John Nichols, thanks for joining us.
It's a great pleasure to be with you on this holiday.
Indeed. John, I know you've been writing about impeachment. Do you think that Ronald Reagan should have been impeached 20 years ago for breaking the law in the Iran-Contra scandal?
There's absolutely no question he should have been impeached.
On what grounds, and why would that be politically important if that had happened?
Two very separate questions, but both very critical. On what grounds? The Congress of the United States passed a resolution specifically telling the president not to give money to the Contra forces in Central America.
Yeah, they couldn't have been clearer about
this is one of those rare moments that it'd be like your mom would say, if the sun shines tomorrow, you can't go out. You wake up, the sun's shining, and you go out, right? She specifically told you not to. Congress specifically told Ronald Reagan and his entire administration that you can't do this.
Yeah.
Well, they did it. And they did it in the most remarkable of ways. They violated the sanctions against Iran. And members of the Reagan administration, going right up to the vice president, mm-hmm. George Bush, arranged for arms sales to the Iranians, who were at war with somebody we liked better at the time, Saddam Hussein.
Now, why does that name ring a bell?
Isn't that funny? Yeah. And so we arranged arms sales to the Iranians, and then with the profits from those arms sales, we then gave the money to the Contras. And there is certainly plenty of evidence to suggest that Ronald Reagan was part and parcel of the process.
And his defense was that he didn't know it was happening, basically.
But the thing is, one of the things that's lost to history is that Reagan initially said, I don't know anything about this. And then, famously, months later, when everything had been revealed, he went on national television and admitted that he was wrong, that he, in fact, had happened, mm-hmm. and that he had been party to information regarding it. And what happened? What happened was an interesting thing. Reagan was at the end of his presidency. He was virtually disempowered. In 1986, Democrats had taken control of the Senate back, and there were a lot of people who said, look, this is an old man. He's obviously suffering from the initial stages of Alzheimer's. And so you ended up in a situation where a lot of Democratic members of Congress said his presidency is almost done. He's disempowered. He's an old man. Let's not hold him to account. Now, the problem with that was I'm sympathetic to all those things. So here's the problem. The presidency is not a man. It is an office, and it is an office that is ongoing. And when it is not held accountable in one administration, it becomes unaccountable in future administrations.
So you think that by essentially letting Reagan off the hook, even if it had been for laudable or sentimental reasons or whatever it was, political calculations, by letting Reagan off the hook, it basically legitimized this type of law-breaking by the executive for future presidencies.
It legitimized the notion that the presidency could seize virtually full control of foreign policy and military policy from Congress. Congress had made its intentions clear. The president had violated them. Those violations were clearly at odds with the Constitution, and the Congress let it pass.
There were about four separate investigations into Iran-Contra, and the big joint House-Senate investigation into Iran-Contra was a very strong statement condemning what had happened and saying that this very clearly broke the law and talking about all the things that were wrong with it. But nothing happened, I mean, to anybody whose name we remember as anything other than a joke.
Well, that's the deal. I mean, I'll remind you that that whole set of hearings and the big House-Senate investigation came down to what was best described by a New York Times reporter as a firm slap on the wrist. And the end result is very significant here, because there was one member of Congress, the former congressman from San Antonio, Texas, Henry B. Gonzalez.
Gonzalez was a Democrat?
He was a Democrat. He was a remarkable man, a child of Mexican immigrants who had grown up in the barrio of San Antonio, gone to law school at night, and ended up as a, you know, very senior Democrat in Congress. When everybody else was letting Reagan off the hook, Henry B. Gonzalez marched to the floor of the House, and he put down a very thorough set of impeachment resolutions. And he said, if we do not hold Ronald Reagan to account, we will see future presidents do far worse. And they will look back to this moment, and they will say, see, the Congress gave us the approval. The Congress essentially set a precedent that presidents can do as they choose.
That even when you have not gotten away with it, even when you have been caught red-handed, even when you have been exposed, you will still not be punished for it. Then
right.
That sets a standard for people who will, A, want to try to get away with it, but know that even when they're caught out, nothing will happen. This is why the Iran-Contra scandal and the legacy of it, for me, is becoming so central to the way I understand what's happening right now. Because if you think about, John, if you think about with what happened with that Iran-Contra investigation, on the one hand, have Henry Gonzalez, whose name is almost lost to history, come out and say, we need to look at this precedent that this is setting for future presidencies and see the danger here. On the other hand, you have the minority report of the Republicans in the House, led by Dick Cheney, coming out with their minority statement saying not only should Reagan not be punished here, but Congress should never have passed a law that says anything about foreign policy in the first place, and this is only the province of the president, and Congress has no business even talking about this, let alone investigating it. And now you see that Henry Gonzalez is lost to history. Dick Cheney, with that random, obscure, obscenely off-the-charts perspective, is vice president, and you see how much we have been twisted.
Well, this is where we tie all the pieces together.
Yeah.
Dick Cheney maneuvered himself into that position as writer of the minority report. And the important thing is that Dick Cheney said in that minority report that Congress shouldn't punish Reagan, but also that the powers of the presidency should be expanded as regards foreign policy. He has held to this view very strongly. When he entered the White House in 2000 as Vice President of the United States, and really effectively as President of Foreign Policy, he moved immediately to do three things that were absolutely critical: to make foreign policy decision-making fully secret, and to close down all sorts of information on what they were doing.
Right.
To dramatically expand the independent intelligence gathering outside the CIA. And finally, and very specifically, the very first cabinet meeting, as we were told by Paul O'Neill, to prepare for a war with Iraq.
Yeah.
When you put these pieces together and you realize that this is the man who was at the center of Iran-Contra, he saw how much danger there was for going way off the deep end, really expanding presidential powers to extreme points. He knew that Congress was not likely to challenge him, and he got in there and did what he thought Reagan should have done, which was much more than Iran-Contra.
Sure. Not to just not to apologize, not to avoid getting caught, but simply to do whatever you want and then assert your right to be there once you're found out.
And now we're lost in this. We're sort of stuck in this Alice in Wonderland world where Dick Cheney's vision has become dominant.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many people, including many Democrats, who sort of accept a playing field, a post-Iran-Contra playing field, that says it would be absurd for Congress to assert itself. It's just not going to happen, right?
Right.
Well, that's not as it should be. The founders said at the Constitutional Convention that they wrote the Constitution. One of them said, his specific quote was, with the intent to chain the dogs of war. They wanted the Constitution to make it virtually impossible for a president to launch a war, be it aggressive or even defensive, without the full approval of Congress, not merely at the time of declaration, but throughout the process. And that is an American legacy of another July 4th,
mm-hmm.
that has been stolen from us. It was stolen. It's been stolen in many pieces at many times. But if you wanted to see the critical point at which we were really robbed, it was during that Iran-Contra fight.
John Nichols is D.C. correspondent for The Nation magazine. His book coming out this fall is called The Genius of Impeachment. John, thanks for joining us this July 4th. I appreciate it.
It's an honor, and I think we've given some good fodder for pictures.
This is a special July 4th edition of The Rachel Maddow Show here on Air America Mornings. We'll be right back with Charlie Savage. He's the Boston Globe reporter who broke the most important story we have yet seen on the George W. Bush presidency's power grab. Stay tuned. This is explosive stuff this July 4th here on The Rachel Maddow Show, Air America Mornings.
24 hours of truth, ads included. Air America Mornings with Rachel Maddow. Rachel Maddow Show on Air America Mornings.
Welcome back on this fine July 4th. This is a special edition of the Rachel Maddow Show here on Air America Mornings. Today, on the nation's birthday, we're taking a little spin around the block in my new obsession, the Iran-Contra scandal, a 20-year-old scandal about presidential power and lawbreaking, where some of the most important players in this current power-mad administration, they tipped their hands, they showed their cards, and revealed their extremist, unprecedented, out-of-bounds, dare I say it, anti-American views about the president as king. The single most important story about George W. Bush's presidential power grab, the most revealing scoop of them all since W. has been president, is the signing statement story. This president's awkward little habit of keeping his fingers crossed behind his back while he's signing laws, essentially reserving the right to ignore and override Congress and U.S. laws whenever he sees fit. Charlie Savage is a legal affairs correspondent with the Boston Globe. And if you know anything about the recent controversy over President Bush's signing statements, it's probably because you've either read Charlie Savage in the Boston Globe or you've heard me talking about it on this show, telling you to go read Charlie Savage about it in the Boston Globe. Charlie hasn't just exposed the extensive use of signing statements by President Bush. He's also recently looked into where the rationale for using them comes from, tracing that rationale back to the Iran-Contra scandal. We caught up with Charlie Savage recently and asked him to explain.
In December of 2005, Dick Cheney gave a really rare press conference. He was on board his plane, I guess Air Force Two, somewhere over the Middle East. He had a few reporters on the plane with him. And he told reporters that if reporters wanted a more detailed understanding of his perspective, which means the administration's perspective, on the limits or lack thereof of presidential power, they should go read this obscure report called the Minority Views Report to the Iran-Contra Committee. And he said no one's ever read it. I mean, he was making fun of it himself, but he said this is what we think. And it turns out that when Congress in 1986 and 87 investigated Iran-Contra, it passed this very long report explaining what had happened, explaining why it was illegal.
Mm-hmm.
All the Democrats on the committee, Congress was dominated by Democrats at the time, signed on to that report. Some of the Republicans also did. But some of the Republicans, led by Cheney, refused to endorse that report, and they produced their own report. And so I went and I read it. And it's
interesting. How did you find it?
There's a reporter who sits next to me or in the office next door to me who's been in Washington for 25 years, and I asked him about it, and he was able to go to his bookcase and sort of blow the dust off and pulled out this thing. And he also had never read the Minority Reviews report. I mean, it's the kind of thing that was just appended to the back of the real report. And it's amazing because it's the same legal arguments that the administration is putting forth now in defense of its warrantless spying program. It's like, you know, this view that was just sort of the crazy view in 1987 that some Republicans signed on to but no one even paid attention to has now become the governing policy of the country because Dick Cheney was elected vice president and his views prevail inside the administration. And the view is this: Congress can't pass laws which restrict a president's power to do whatever he wants in the spheres of foreign affairs and national security. This is their view. These laws are not binding on the president because they're invalid.
What you've proven and what you've been able to trace back is that this was a fully formed idea about the balance of power in government that Cheney brought to bear on Iran-Contra, that he's bringing to bear on the war on terror now, that he's bringing to bear on questions that have come up in the Bush administration from the very beginning, even before 9/11. And it doesn't really have anything to do with the fact that we're at war. He just wants Congress to be less powerful in relationship to the president.
Yes and no. I would say the nuances of this are we were at war from Dick Cheney's perspective in, you know, in 1986. It was the Cold War, and there were Soviet missiles pointed at us. He qualifies this, or he characterizes this approach to presidential power as being one of necessity because the world is so dangerous that you need someone who's going to be responsible for national security and foreign affairs, who can move quickly, who isn't hobbled by indecision and regulations that he has to jump through that are going to slow down what is necessary for the protection of the country. A view that rests upon a need for a perpetual crisis atmosphere. At every moment of the Cold War or now, at every moment of the endless war on terrorism, we're always on the verge of being annihilated. And therefore, the president needs to be all-powerful in these certain spheres.
Out of the last 65 years, the United States has been at war for all but 14, all but some portion of 14 in the last 65 years. So if wartime is going to be the justification for something that we otherwise wouldn't need to do, then wartime justifies a whole change in government that's essentially permanent.
I've done a bit of research in connection with this of, you know, how did the founders who wrote the Constitution understand the commander-in-chief power? Where do they think it stopped? What do they want the president to be and not to be? What was the original understanding of all this?
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back and you read the Federalist Papers, which three of the founders wrote to explain every word and comma of the Constitution, they certainly did not envision this. They specifically warned against the propensity of the person who is in charge of national security creating a crisis atmosphere in order to justify gathering more power unto himself. This is the nature of man. You'll do this, and then you'll get more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And they specifically also wanted not to have a king, and specifically the thing that they didn't, because they just fought a war to get rid of a king.
Yeah.
And the thing that the British king could do, who was also the commander-in-chief of the British army, was that he could decide when we're going to go to war or when the Brits would go to war. He could decide when to stop. He could create armies. And he had something called the royal prerogative power, which was the power to act as he saw fit in the public good, for the public good, sometimes even in defiance of, in the absence of law or even in defiance of law, if that's what it took. And this is essentially the same idea which is now, you know, 200 years later, been sort of grafted onto the president, the White House, the commander-in-chief over the last, you know, 50 years at increasing levels, maybe reaching its one climax at the Nixon White House and reaching another one now.
Charlie Savage, thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate it
for taking the time.
Coming up next hour, we will pry me off the Iran-Contra thing here on The Rachel Maddow Show. We'll give you a few other political things to panic about and some soothing exclusive in-studio musical performances to calm you back down afterwards. Breathe in, breathe out. You're a duck. Let it roll off you. Happy July 4th. This is a special edition of The Rachel Maddow Show.
This is The Rachel Maddow Show on Air America Mornings, live from Air America's flagship station in New York City. Here's Rachel Maddow.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, the 4th of July, 2006. It's 6 minutes past the hour right now, and this is The Rachel Maddow Show here on Air America Mornings. Happy 4th of July. Very excited about the show this morning, our special edition of The Rachel Maddow Show. Last hour, we talked about the Iran-Contra scandal from 20 years ago, which in a sense is like ancient history, but honestly, I think that Iran-Contra provides a better lesson right now on what's happening with our government than anything else that we can see in the day's headlines. The Iran-Contra scandal really lays bare what the heck it is they're trying to do to the government. The beginnings of a push for a wackily, off-the-charts, extremely powerful executive branch in this country. Specifically the drive toward that by the man who's in charge of all the scariest things in our government right now, and that is Vice President Dick Cheney. This hour, we are going to move away from the Contra scandal that I'm obsessed with, but we are still talking about how the government and our country are changing under the Bush administration, how the executive branch is getting more and more powerful, how the country is shunning international expectations and norms in an unprecedented way, the real radicalness of this administration. On June 6th of this year, we learned that we're no longer referencing the Geneva Conventions when we talk about the rules of war in this country. And on the day that we learned that news, I talked about it on The Underbelly. Here's The Underbelly segment from June 6, 2006. And as you know, we do enjoy poking a sharp stick at the soft white underbelly of the right-wing scheme machine. Giving you a little peek at their political playbook. You know, it was no secret when Bush came into office that he had no interest in international institutions, and that the people who came into office with him, people like Dick Cheney in particular, had no interest in international institutions and international norms. They scrapped the Kyoto Agreement on global warming. They sent John Bolton as the ambassador to the UN, a man who said he would basically like to blow up the UN. You know, it's basically this America first doctrine, screw the rest of the world, the international institutions and norms just hold us back from what we need to do. So the International Criminal Court, no thank you. International legal precedent, uh-uh, we're not interested. We don't do international things, we do it alone. Except sometimes when, you know, Palau comes with us, like in our coalition of the willing, billing, dwindling, or whatever. But where does the rejection of anything international, of any agreement between nations whatsoever, where does that hit a wall with these guys? Even if they think only in terms of American interests, what's best for our country and screw the rest of the world, even if they make some vaguely principled stand for ignoring the rest of the world, you might think that there's one international thing we ought to do for ourselves, and that is to at least pay lip service to Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, which governs how you get treated as a prisoner in wartime. You may remember what Joe Biden had to say about this in the initial controversy over us torturing people.
There's a reason why we signed these treaties. To protect my son in the military. That's why we have these treaties. So when Americans are captured, they are not tortured. That's the reason. In case anybody forgets it, that's the reason.
Senator Joe Biden, Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions for seven decades has unified the civilized countries of the world in adhering to minimum standards of decent behavior toward people captured and detained during war. More than 70 years. The LA Times reported yesterday that the Pentagon's revision of the Army Field Manual under Bush, remember him?
Any activity we conduct is within the law. We do not torture.
We do not torture. The new Army Field Manual and its directive on how we treat and question prisoners removes any reference to the Geneva Conventions, removes the reference to Article 3. We have always referenced the Geneva Conventions in our domestic military rules, if for no other reason, if not for common decency and what it means to be a civilized country. We've done it for, if for no other reason than the fact that it provides protection to our troops, too, to know that this is the law that we say as a nation we will stand by. And the LA Times report yesterday, it says that Bush's civilian lawyers have taken the Geneva Convention references out of the Army field book. And it's the civilian lawyers who have made this decision over the objections of the military's lawyers, because it is more important to them that America not have any reference to anything international in the world, no matter how good it is for us, than to actually do something that the military knows protects our own troops. You would think that would be their wall. You would think that would be the place they would not go with their so-called principled rejection of any international agreement. If the law of gravity had originated in the UN, we would be absenting ourselves from the law of gravity right now. All right, we aired That Underbelly originally on June 6th. It's 27 minutes past the hour right now, and you are listening to a special edition, a special July 4th edition of The Rachel Maddow Show here on Air America Mornings, where we, if nobody else, are on a crusade to save our form of government from the radicals who would take it from us.
No hard stuff, no heavy metal, just smooth, relaxing, representational democracy. The Rachel Maddow Show on Air America Mornings.
Welcome back. This is the Rachel Maddow Show here on Air America Mornings. We're doing a special pre-recorded edition of the show for this 4th of July, and we are taking this time to replay some of the stories we've covered over the past few months about how the government, actually literally our form of government, is changing under the Bush administration, how the Bush administration is changing the way the government relates to the people in this country, the most fundamental thing a government can do. Some of the most alarming changes have been secret ones, kept out of view for security reasons, right? One of those secret shifts was revealed in December when, you will remember, the New York Times broke the story that the president had authorized the NSA, the National Security Agency, to listen in on Americans' phone calls. That authorization was secret, of course, and he meant for them to do it without the warrants that were required by law. The president's response to the resulting hue and cry?
If somebody from Al-Qaeda is calling you, we'd like to know why.
On top of that, in mid-May, USA Today reported that the NSA was secretly collecting phone call records from tens of millions of Americans using data actually handed over by phone companies, AT&T, Bell South, Verizon. If that wasn't enough to make you run out and buy a huge stash of tinfoil hats, here's the next chapter in that story. USA Today had been working on that story about telecom companies giving our phone information, our phone records, to the government for weeks. The night before the story was published, they called Bell South, USA Today called Bell South, and said, this is what's going to be in the story. Do you have any further comment, any response for us to put in the story? And Bell South said, nope, just the same thing they had already said in the article, which was, they said, we don't give confidential information to the government without proper legal authority. Same thing they had always said. Then 5 days later, Bell South lost their minds. They came out and said, not only do we deny having anything to do with this scandal whatsoever, but now we demand a retraction. The question is, what happened in those 5 days? From when they were fine with the story to when they were enraged by the story. What's going on here? Why the change in tactics? Then I read an article by Lorraine Wallert in the May 29th edition of Business Week. It was called The Snooping Goes Beyond Phone Calls. And it basically explained what happened in that five-day period. We caught up with Lorraine Wallert back in May, right after the article came out, and I asked her to explain exactly how government agencies and private companies are getting around the laws that are supposed to protect us from government spying.
There's at least two laws on the books, and actually there are more, but two key ones. There's the Privacy Act of 1974, which says basically that the government has to report whenever they're collecting data on us. There was the E-Government Act in 2002, which built on that, that said, look, anytime an agency collects data on individuals, it has to do a privacy impact statement, basically study ways to make sure that that data is secure and accurate, et cetera. So those two laws are on the books now.
The main point of your article, and what I found fascinating, is that there is actually a pretty wide loophole in this law involving once you bring in third parties, once the government isn't directly collecting this information, but rather using companies and third parties to collect the information.
Right? Rachel, that's the gist of it.
Yeah.
There is a huge loophole that all government agencies are driving through. That is that if they buy data, they don't have to follow these two laws. The GAO has, you know, done numerous studies on this subject, and they've come up with a few numbers. Back in 2004, when they looked at this subject, they found 122 agencies operating 131 data mining programs.
131 data mining programs, and if they're buying commercial databases, just that act of getting them through a third party rather than collecting the data themselves literally as government employees, that excludes them from the protections that we have from the Privacy Act.
That's what the agencies claim. That's correct. And so what that means is we don't know what's being collected. We don't know whether it's accurate. We don't have access to our own information that the government has. And in addition, the government can purchase data that it can't collect under law. So in other words, the Privacy Act prohibits the government from collecting certain information about individuals. For example, you know, what videos you rent at the store.
Right.
But I can go out as an agency and buy that information.
So the reason this gets to the phone companies for me is that there are private companies out there who specifically market themselves as middlemen for handling the government's requests for information from phone companies, which happens all the time. There are companies out there that market themselves as middlemen, saying, hey, phone companies, hire us, and then every time the government wants something from you in terms of citizen information, we'll deal with the request.
That's correct. I think it's sort of becoming a little niche industry, and apparently a pretty lucrative one. We have a company like that here right in the outskirts of D.C., a company called Neustar, which actually markets itself as a go-to person for phone companies whenever the phone companies get a request from a federal agency.
Following up on your story, after you wrote your story in Business Week this week, the folks at online at tpmmuckraker.com followed up with what they knew about Neustar, found some promotional materials from Neustar in which Neustar explicitly markets itself as a scapegoat, saying to marketing itself to telecom companies, saying, we will be the scapegoat so that if any of the government's requests for information turn out to be illegal, we will take the blame, and you, telecom company, do not have to.
Well, and there's another twist to this, and I don't know if this applies to Neustar specifically, but there's a set of principles out there called fair information practices that are basically supposed to be adopted by federal agencies and the private sector. But resellers claim that they don't have to abide by fair information practices because they don't actually obtain their information directly from individuals. In other words, they buy the information too, and so it's not necessarily appropriate for them to, for example, make sure it's accurate, et cetera.
If you just imagine this is about, like, buying a stolen flat-screen TV, you want a new TV, you're thinking about going down to the corner to buy one from the dodgy guy down there who's always got them on sale, and you think, ah, but I don't want to get busted for buying stolen goods. Therefore, I'll have my little brother go down and buy the stolen goods. And then little brother, oh, he's a juvenile. He won't get any hard time. I mean, it's that kind of, I mean, it's really, it's not very complicated. It's a nasty little way around all these important laws.
Well, and the most, one of the more important points is that, you know, you and I don't know what is being recorded, and the way that the laws are now, we don't have a right to know what's recorded about us. There's no way for us to access this information to make sure it's accurate.
We have no rights for ensuring that this is accurate, and yet some of this stuff is being used for very important government purposes that can, you know, get us on the no-fly list or get our houses raided or get our calls listened to or anything. It has real-world consequences.
Exactly. I mean, most of, let's see, here's a GAO report that said, 24% of agencies use data mining to detect fraud, waste, and abuse. Well, you know, if your information isn't accurate, how effective can that data mining be?
Wow. Well, Lorraine Wohler, thank you for reporting on this thus far, and thanks for joining us today. It's really illuminating. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Rachel.
I spoke with Lorraine Wohler on May 24th of this year, but so far we have not found out much more about the government's warrantless data mining operation, largely because the Justice Department is too busy shutting down any lawsuits or investigations. For national security reasons, of course. Coming up next, we're taking an Independence Day musical interlude, spending some time with a band of bird watchers named, of course, after a bird. You're listening to The Rachel Maddow Show, our special edition for July 4th here on Air America Mornings.